You can't train a guy on radio and then be like, now it's podcast. Do what you want.
that's what you tried to do to me. You've been doing that to me for 4 years. Hello?
That's true. Oh my but look how God. Great you turned out.
Well.
You're just like a tenderized steak. Oh, shucks.
Hey, everybody. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Welcome back to Make Me Smart, where none of us, including the tenderized steaks, is as smart as all of us.
I am Molly Wood. Welcome to the show. It is Tuesday, which means indeed we're getting ourselves some help. It is time for a dive into a single topic. Today, although we have tried to avoid it, we tried to stop everybody from making it a thing. Here it is. So we're just going to try to understand what's going on with the inflation conversation.
Inflation, 9 letters, 3 syllables, inflation. So all kinds of macroeconomic talk about that, about why it's happening, is it going to happen, is it going to last, all of those things. It's the Fed's job, right? We've talked about this on Marketplace a lot. It's the Fed's job to control inflation, right? Part of their dual mandate is stable prices. Fed likes inflation right around 2%. We can talk about why that is. Has not been able to get there for a very long time. And now with rising prices on the horizon, a lot of people are getting really nervous. A lot of people are getting nervous.
Yep. So here to make us smart is, once again, backed by popular demand, Mark Blythe. He's a political economist at the Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs at Brown University. Welcome back to the show.
It's always a pleasure to be regarded as smart.
Hope springs eternal, I think, for all of us. Well, let's start with the definitions, because inflation, as I understand it, is more than just things are slightly more expensive. What is the metric for what inflation actually is?
Ooh, that's the big one. All right, so I'm going to give you a story.
I went straight to the big one. I thought this was the easy one.
No, this is a good one, right? Back in 2011, Bill Dudley, who's one of the Fed governors, was out giving a speech about inflation. And he made the following point, that when you think about things like technology, the cost of autos over the long run, you think about electronics, you think about apparel, prices have actually been going down. And that's why it seems that even though certain things are going up, and you may experience that in your day-to-day experience of going to the store and stuff, actually they've been going down. And someone said, can you give me an example? And he said, yeah, well, think about the cost of an iPad. To which someone shouted out from the back, you can't eat an iPad.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of the crux of the whole thing, because inflation, as we want to understand it, is a rise in the general level of all prices, and a consistent rise that feeds on itself, and it just becomes self-sustaining. That's very different from what we experience, which is things go up and down, and a lot of things that we care about, particularly in our own consumption baskets, rent, health, education, have definitely been going up. But that's not the same thing as a general rise in all prices. And that's what we're worrying about when we talk about an inflation.
Okay, so can you put us in this current moment? We're coming out of a pandemic, which was economically unusual in 1,000 different ways. The economy is reopening. People want to spend. There's trillions of dollars of fiscal stimulus, that is government spending, going into this economy. Where are we now?
All right. So you know how we were talking about a K-shaped recovery?
Mm-hmm.
So basically the upper leg of the K is people have got assets, and then the other ones, people have got wages, and it's up for one and down for the other. You should think about a K-shaped future. And here's why. We had a huge supply and demand shock called the COVID crisis, and we're beginning to get out of it. Now, let's think about housing as a good example here. Last year, housing starts completely stopped, more or less. At the same time, lumber supplies dwindled. Why? Because people who are on the top leg of that K thought, hey, we're stuck at home, honey. Why don't we finally get that extension on the house that we wanted? So there was still construction going on. Now housing starts are starting again. Guess what? There's a lumber shortage. Prices are going up. So a lot of this is coming from the supply side, right? It's the pandemic effect. Now, if this was on the demand side, if this is the money causing inflation story, you need to think about two things. The first set of big checks that went out have now all been spent. And Americans are still about $50 billion in rent arrears. So clearly that wasn't enough to like soak it all up. The next set of checks actually have just gone out and haven't really shown up yet in the spending. So it can't be that that's driving it. So on balance, what the Fed thinks and what I think is that you've got quite naturally a lot of what we call bottlenecks, a lot of supply shortages right across different sectors that are all coming out of hibernation at once. So guess what? Prices are getting bed up. What the Fed is betting is that this is a temporary effect and it will settle down after a few months.
And it sounds like you agree.
I do agree, actually, because the counterfactual on this one is you kind of need to explain why it is that for years and years before this, you talked about the 2% target. Why is it we haven't been able to hit just 2%? Since the Fed declared it had a mandate back in 2011-12, it literally hasn't managed to hit it. The ECB hasn't managed to hit it since 2008. What does that suggest? It suggests that there is a lot of spare capacity in the economy. It suggests that you can push on wages a lot without producing inflation. And in fact, the Trump administration proved this. When Trump got into his tweets war back in 2017 with the Fed, don't you dare raise interest rates. Mm-hmm. What he basically was saying is, we're going to run the economy really hot. Don't you dare kill it with higher interest rates. And what happened was wages started to go up for the bottom 20% and 40% of the income distribution for the first time in a long time. And what the Biden administration are doing through Treasury and what Fed is doing is essentially saying, hey, maybe we should try that. Maybe we should get more wage growth going in the economy. Maybe that K-shaped recovery shouldn't be such a K.
All right. So this all started, this whole conversation, it seems to me, with Larry Summers, former Treasury Secretary and National Economic Council chairperson and grand poobah of many things economic for a very long time. Like in February-ish, he wrote a piece in the Washington Post, I think, in which he said, oh, my God, inflation. And just today, he says, at an Atlanta Fed event, the primary risks today include overheating, asset price inflation, and subsequent financial excessive leverage, borrowing, and subsequent financial instability. Why do you think he is saying that? Because he's a smart guy. He knows about bottlenecks and pent-up demand and all of that.
Well, you'll notice, Kai, that he didn't actually say inflation. What he actually said was people are going to borrow too much money to bet on rising asset prices in an era of low interest rates and low inflation, and that's going to cause financial instability. That's not an inflation claim. Now, will there be some rising prices? Absolutely. But honestly, you never know about an inflation as a general rise in the increase of all prices until you're about a year to 18 months out, because you have to see that sustained period-on-period increase. So what's happening is that investors are becoming completely frenetic about this and are rubbernecking at the window every 24 hours going, our price is going up, our price is going up, good God, it must be an inflation. And it's like, dude, you won't know for a year. Calm down.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, and I feel like that's the part that we were sort of saying at the top of the show. We've been trying to avoid that conversation because it does feel like it's very soon. And I guess I'm trying to figure out what it is that everyone is so worried about, because if raising interest rates is the tool to fight inflation, it also seems like no one wants that to happen.
Right. Nobody wants that to happen, kind of, right? We know that it works. Uh-huh. We know that it's a brutal tool, right? But, you know, let's remember that when you raise interest rates, you're making a kind of distributional choice. What you're doing is you're rewarding savers and punishing borrowers. So it's not that everybody loses when you do interest rates. Similarly with inflation, the notion that, oh my God, it's this terrible thing and we'll all become the Weimar Republic. No, that hardly ever happens. Broadly speaking, inflation is a kind of random redistributionary tax. And it depends on exactly who you are, tells you how your assets are going to be affected. So why is it the billionaire class gets freaked out about inflation, despite the fact that you could tax them at 60% and they'd still be billionaires? Because inflation's a kind of a tax on future profitability. If they're bond investors and rates go up, the value of bonds going down, they lose money. So who's the most sensitive to inflation? Well, the argument is, oh, it's the poor on fixed income. No, it's Wall Street. Wall Street wants to know that its net margins are going to still be good net margins, and that's what bothers them.
Can we dip back into history for a second? You mentioned the Weimar Republic, and my guess would be that if you asked Americans, those of whom who study history will say, if you ask them about inflation, they'll say, oh, well, there was pre-World War II Germany. And then, of course, 1979 through 1982 in the United States with Paul Volcker and all that. Why is inflation such a bugaboo? Why is the Fed worried about it accelerating and Summers and everybody?
Because in the 70s, it was a problem. You had super tight labor markets and high government spending coming out of the Vietnam and Great Society periods. You had women and also minorities joining the labor force for the first time in mass without big capital deepening to absorb that labor. So it all showed up in wages, and then it showed up in prices, and you got the wage price spiral. And it basically killed the post-war growth model that everyone had become accustomed to. And the people in the Fed, who today are 60 years old, they cut their teeth on that. That's their formative experience. They cannot think past that moment. Now, the crazy thing about it is, if you actually look at inflation, we started to deflate after the Volcker shock. Globally, we deflated pretty much down to where we should be by about 1987. And in the developed world, there has been no inflation of consequence ever since. So essentially, think about the ECB, the European Central Bank. It set up in 1999 with a 2% inflation target to guard against an inflation that died 15 years previously and hasn't been seen since. Right. If you want a wartime analogy for this, it's the French generals. They're really brilliant at fighting the last war, but the next one, that's a bit of a tough one.
Well, another thing that I hear you saying is that in all of this, what does sound to be fairly unfounded freak out about inflation, the people who are most worried about it, investors and billionaires, could end up forcing potentially an increase in interest rates that would then kill wages. Like, I want to go back to the thing you said about how if interest rates stay really low, and even if prices go up a little bit, wages might go up, which seems like a good thing that we wouldn't want to kill.
Absolutely. I mean, one way to think about Bidenomics to the extent that it exists, and we kind of talked very briefly about this last time, this is a bet against Trumpism. And I don't mean that against Republicans or Trump. I mean, basically against populism, against the forces of populism that propelled Trump into office, which, according to most economists, is caused by the fact that we've had a long period of real wage stagnation. And because of that, the cost of living that people experience, not what it says in the inflation index, has been a real and increasing burden. That has led to anger, that has led to frustration, that has led to a loss of faith in governing institutions and governing elites. And essentially, this Biden stimulus isn't just about we need to build back better. It's about we need to rebuild America. We need to rebuild the confidence of the American working and middle classes in the capitalist economic model. And if that means that we need to boost prices and wages just now to get people to feel better and more secure, then that's what we got to do, because the alternative is not very pleasant.
All right. So let's say in a year, we've got inflation consistent, 18 months, in 18 months, inflation consistently running well above 2%, which is the Fed has said it will tolerate for a while. Then what happens? What is that going to look like?
Well, it depends on the real rate. And here's what that means. Your inflation rate is relative to your interest rate and your growth rate. So if you're growing at 5% and your inflation's at 2, that's awesome. That's 3% real. That's like money for nothing, right? If it's 4% and you're growing at 3%, it's a 1% inflation. Please, you wouldn't get out of bed for that. It would only be an issue if we were growing at 1% and inflation was at 5%. Then you'd have a 4% inflation and we might have something to worry about. But to get there, we would need to boost wages, bust through capacity constraints, exhaust the absorption capacity of the labor market, and a whole host of other things, which frankly, if we did it, it would be awesome. And it might be worth paying that price.
Do you think that the Biden administration and the Fed will hold firm?
I do. And here's why. It's a lesson that we learned during the financial crisis. Never bet against the central bank. Yeah. Because at the end of the day, they control interest rates. You work with interest rates. Don't bite the hand that feeds you.
Yeah. And Jay, I mean, honestly, Jay Powell can't back down now, right? I mean.
Right. If he does, then the whole notion of credibility is gone, because if essentially 6 weeks of shouting from the windows that the sky is falling is enough to alter Fed policy, you don't have Fed policy.
Right. Mark Blythe at Brown. Mark, thanks so much. I really appreciate your insights. Good stuff.
Yeah. Thanks a lot.
Always a pleasure.
Here we go. Don't bet against the central bank.
Okay. We put that to bed, everyone.
Boom. Done. No more talk about inflation.
Bed. Just. We're moving on.
Blast this out there.
If you want to play the drinking game on CNBC, that's on you. We're over it. Thanks to Mark. All right, we're headed to a break. Send us your comments on today's show. You can do that by sending us an email or a voice memo to makemesmart@marketplace.org. We look forward to hearing with you from you, and we'll be right back.
Is that me? I'm right back.
Love that guy.
You're back.
Love him.
Yeah, he's great.
We're back.
He's great.
Yep. All right. What you got? It's time for, by the way, the news fix. That's what's happening now. We came back. We're going to talk about a little news. Then we're going to go to the mailbag. You might be new here. If so, welcome. This is what happens. Little signposting just for you.
Where you been? All right, let's do you first.
Okay, so we have been talking a lot about Tesla and self-driving cars and the kind of living lab that company has turned us all into by sort of overstating its claims about what its cars can do in terms of self-driving capability, which apparently is causing dum-dums to climb into the backseat of their cars and let Teslas drive themselves until they either get pulled over or die. As a result, apparently the California Department of Motor Vehicles has Tesla under review to determine whether indeed the electric car maker misleads customers by advertising its, quote, full self-driving capability option. This is according to the LA Times. The Tesla, to be clear, no car can do full self-driving right now. Yeah. That does not exist. Tesla, we talked about this last week, I think, that despite what Elon Musk frequently says, which is like, we'll have a fully self-driving car by next year, and they call this feature autopilot and talk about its full self-driving capability, it can do what is commonly referred to as level 2 self-driving capability, which is it can change lanes by itself. It can do a lot, right? It can take highway exit ramps, stop at traffic lights, stop at stop signs on its own, but you have to have a person in the car with their hands on the wheel, according to widely accepted engineering standards. Yeah. And so now the DMV is going to try to determine whether Tesla's been basically overstating things to the extent that dum-dums are like, let's try it.
Yeah. Yeah. We did an interview, you and me, on Marketplace. It's got to be 5 years ago now. In which you laid out exactly how hard this whole self-driving thing is. And it's just as fast as technology is moving, this is that hard that it's still ahead of the technology. You know, it's just so, so hard.
It is. I looked up actually an interview that I did 3 years ago now in 2018 with a woman who was an auto analyst at Duke, then at Duke, who's a former fighter pilot. And she couldn't have minced fewer words on the topic of these promises about the self-driving capability, even back then. And she said, you know, unquestionably, this is going to get people killed. And she's like, if you're flying a jet, I'm sure you can relate to this. I'll send you the interview. She's like, the last moment where you want the pilot to intervene is at the last moment. Like, you want them to be paying attention the whole time.
Right.
And at level 2, which is where we are still 3 years later, people still have to be paying attention. And to promise otherwise is dangerous. Like, we will determine whether it's legally dangerous. But I feel like if you're a business, assume dum-dum in your customers.
Yep. That's a safe way to do it. And that's just not – Musk has never done that, right? Tesla has never done that. And
nope.
That's
and we're
why
their,
this is
we're
out.
Their guinea pigs now. Yeah.
Okay, businesses, one more time for my news item. Janet Yellen, Secretary of the Treasury, also the former Fed Chair and White House National Economic Council Director, just to, you know, give her bona fides one more time, went into the belly of the beast today and gave a speech at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce in which she called for an increase in corporate taxes to fund President Biden's $2.3 trillion stimulus plan. And number one, interesting that she did that. Number two, I thought the chamber's response was remarkable here because the chamber is in favor of almost all of these infrastructure plans, right? I mean, they understand childcare as people needing somebody to take care of the kids so they can go to work. They understand bridges and railroads, right? They get it. But the response from Suzanne Clark, the head of the U.S. chamber, immediately after Yellen stopped speaking was, yeah, no, don't raise business taxes. We think instead it should be funded another way, including by user fees, which is to say taxes on those who use the services, which are almost always regressive taxes because they fall disproportionately on middle and low income families. And it's tax policy in another guise being played out in Infrastructure Week. And here we go. And the Republicans are going to come out with their plan here in a day or two. And we're going to have this whole go round. And where business is coming down is not on raising taxes, even though they now pay 21% taxes and don't even want to talk about 25%. So that's that.
And by the way, Ms. Yellen said that corporate taxes are at a historical low of 1% of gross domestic product. I mean, it is pretty, I am not unaware that the Chamber of Commerce represents businesses of all sizes. But we are at a point in the global economy where, you know, even to the interview we just did, you have some of the richest companies that have ever existed throughout time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You have unfathomable income inequality where like 20 people are as wealthy as 4 billion. And you have billionaires on Wall Street. And these people are essentially arguing about pennies. And arguing about pennies to the extent that they're like, no, we would rather that all those other people who are not wealthy, we want them to pay so that we don't have to pay these pennies, even to fix roads and bridges so that people don't they don't fall down and kill people. I mean, it is pretty astonishing.
It's kind of wild.
I'm also glad that you raised this because I'm so increasingly interested in this idea of the global minimum corporate tax. Mm-hmm. You repeated her call for this, the idea that there shouldn't be this race to the bottom where countries compete for investment by basically being like, you don't have to pay that much if you come here.
Yeah. That was another big Yellen speech from like 6 weeks ago where she called for this, you know, obviously on behalf of her boss, a global minimum tax in the U.S. at 21%. And
it's fascinating.
It is totally fascinating. You have to believe, though, that she's spitting into the wind, right? Because just as one country, right? And Stephen Beard did this story for us on Marketplace a couple of days ago. Ireland at 12.5% has reaped billions and billions and trillions of dollars in proceeds and profits because of its low corporate tax rate, because American companies go there and say, hey, 12.5%, this is awesome. You know, so I don't know.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, it depends on how much you think income inequality writ large is a global existential threat. You know, I guess like that's the question, is at what point then does Ireland start to have those problems, those same problems of inequality to an extent that it destabilizes like their democracy and leads to populist revolt? And, you know, it's like a pretty one-to-one in terms of income inequality and unrest, generally, historically speaking. So I guess it depends on how widely those consequences start to be felt, right. I suppose. Short term,
totally fair.
Yes, I agree with you.
Fair
spit.
Enough.
Super spit.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
Before we get to the mailbag, just a reminder, because it is the last day. We're in the middle of our fun drive. And I don't think it's the last day of our fun drive, but it's the last day of our $100,000 dollar for dollar match from the American Public Media board, our own board.
Which
I get
we
kind
love,
of excited
of
when
course.
I get to do public radio stuff still. I'm still new. Still new enough.
New enough.
Anyway,
yes.
through Tuesday at midnight.
Tonight. It's a $100,000 match from the board of directors, for which we are obviously grateful, despite all that stuff I've said about them in the past. Marketplace.org/givesmart, or there's a link that Tony's going to put in the show notes. Also, my resignation letter will be there as well, I suppose. I don't know. Anyway, help us out. Help us out.
I'm going to get one of those, makemesmart.org/givesmart. I'm going to get one of those sound effect thingies. I'm going to find one specifically that has a zipper sound so I can be like, zip it.
Zip it. Two things we should say before we get out of fundraising mode. Number one, we do a tote bag now. I forget what the premium is for that, but we do a tote bag. Also, we're doing a Stonk Tales zine. We're bringing zines back. You can cut that and print it. We're bringing zines back. They're really cool. So there's some of the drink recipes from back when we were doing Stonk Tales, and they're really good. And it's really well done.
And
by the way,
the tote bag is designed by a listener.
Yeah,
which is crazy and amazing, and it's really cute. I got one in the mail thanks to Sharon and Smith. It is adorable. All right,
excellent.
Moving on to
Garrett,
the mailbag.
Do that thing.
Hello, Molly and Kai.
It's Brianna from Phoenix.
Ivan from Brooklyn, New York.
Longtime listener, first time voicemailer.
I want to discuss a slightly different, but maybe related thing.
Okay, so we did school reopening a week or two ago. I can't actually remember. Heard from a lot of teachers who wanted to make us smart about hybrid teaching. Here is just one of the voice memos we got. Mm-hmm. Play it.
Hi, this is Heather from Las Vegas,
Hi,
and I am currently teaching high school biology in a hybrid setting, and I just want to let Molly know that, yes, it is that hard. I've been trying to come up with an analogy to explain the challenges of hybrid teaching. It's maybe like when you do the YouTube live show on Fridays, except you also have people live in your studio, and you have to interact with everyone in person and online, but some people on the YouTube live stream lose connection here and there, so they miss parts of your explanation, and so you have to repeat it, which makes the people live in your studio lose attention because they've already heard it. And you have to try and get the live people in your studio to interact with the people on the YouTube live stream and the people on the YouTube live stream to interact with the people live in your studio. And really only a few people in person and a few people in the YouTube live stream are actually interested in the topic you're discussing. And the rest just have to be there compulsorily. And the show is an hour and 45 minutes and you're wearing a mask the whole time. And every day feels like Hollowed Out Shell Thursday. And also there's no cocktails. Anyway, love the show, but I don't wish hybrid teaching on anyone.
Fair enough.
Yeah. Yeah.
Excellent. Excellent explanation, Heather.
Really good. Excellent explanation, Heather. Thank you. Yeah. And at least cocktails. I suppose it's not cool to sneak those in. Okay. Thank you to all the teachers who responded to that as well. Let's get to a voice memo we got about Apple's new privacy feature.
Hi, Kai and Molly. Damien from Ridgefield, Connecticut. Just wanted to say a couple of things about the privacy thing. I got asked in an app yesterday if I wanted to continue. Sorry, that's my wife on the Peloton. She's singing in the background. I got asked if I wanted to continue having more thoughtful recommendations or less thoughtful recommendations. And it took me more than a few seconds to figure out that SAT question of what they were asking me. And really what I realized was less thoughtful recommendations meant less invasion into my privacy. Mm-hmm. So I clicked less thoughtful. So yeah, they might try to confuse us a little bit with that one.
More singing. Wow. More singing.
I need to have more fun on my Peloton.
I know,
seriously.
Right?
Oh, I don't have a Peloton, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Oh, amazing.
Less thoughtful. Yeah.
That is ridiculous.
Yeah. And look, the way Apple set it up in its software, in its OS, is confusing as well. So you got to be really paying attention, because while they want to protect your privacy, they kind of a little bit don't want to protect your privacy. Mm-hmm. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yep.
All right. One more voice memo. It's a tag team job, actually, from a colleague of ours here at Marketplace.
Hi, Molly and Kai. This is Carrie, your friendly neighborhood copy editor.
Carrie!
And I'm sitting in the parking lot of our local Walgreens with my 14-year-old son, Max, who just got his first vaccine.
Nice.
I have never seen a kid so happy to get a shot before. Now our lives open up and our personal economies open up. And Max, do you have anything to say?
Once I get that second shot, I'm gonna try to fit a year's worth of missed stuff into 1 month.
Yeah, buddy. Gotta pace yourself, though. Gotta pace yourself.
Yeah. You and all the girls in Palm Springs, buddy. Just be careful. Just be careful out there. I love this so much. I got my son his first shot Thursday, last Thursday. I mean, I was, you know, like the second that the appointments opened up, I was like, burr, burr, burr. And I will tell you, it was the best day of the entire pandemic for me.
That's great. That's great.
Yep.
For sure.
To know that my baby was going to be okay.
Yeah.
Also, Carrie, excellent knitter. Such a great knitter.
Really?
Yep. Totally.
Who'd have known?
Great knitter. Yep. Hmm. Okay. Now we're going to leave you with the answer to the Make Me Smart question, which is, what is something you thought you knew you later found out you were wrong about? Katie in Connecticut sent us her answer a couple weeks ago.
Something that I thought I knew but later found out I was wrong about was just how much I identify with the different moods of the co-hosts. There's just something special about Molly's rage against capitalism and the patriarchy, because I feel that deep, deep within my bones. But this week, Kai busted out with his bizarro Babaro impression, which was just an amazing mood. And then on Friday got all dishy, writing page 6 blind items about the staff. And I just, man. I needed that. And I didn't know how much I needed it, but thank you. Thank you so much.
page 6 blind items.
I want, Katie, I want you to write the reviews of our show. Bizarro Barbaro,
Whoa.
Stop it. Whoa. Also, I clearly have to listen to Friday's show. That sounds amazing.
No, it was a couple of weeks ago.
That sounds
amazing. You were there for that one. Oh, that was us.
Right.
Yeah. Although Amy and I had a good time.
Oh, I thought it was about the staff. Okay. Got it. Katie, you are welcome. One thing I want to say, I had to fact check this during the mailbag, but the tote, when I said it was designed by a listener, it's Audie Norman. Yeah. The guy at Oddly Normal on Twitter, who, if you have ever seen the incredible like cartoon poster art, he's the one that did like me driving a motorcycle with Kai in the sidecar. That is the guy who did the tote. So you want it. You want to get it. And I just want to make sure we shouted him out by name because he's so talented and great.
Yeah.
That's it.
All right. Your answer to the Make Me Smart question, please. The question, of course, is what is something you thought you knew but later found out you were wrong about? You can reach us at makemesmart@marketplace.org.
See you tomorrow. Oh, it's what do you want to know Wednesday, too? So last-minute questions are welcome, friends.
Bring them in.
Oh, it's already Wednesday. How exciting.
Yeah. Make Me Smart is produced and directed by Marissa Cabrera. Tony Wagner is our digital producer. Erica Phillips writes our newsletters, also our smart speaker skills.
Today's program was engineered by Garrett Lang with mixing by Juan Carlos Dorado. Ben Holliday and Daniel Ramirez composed our theme music. The senior producer is Bridget Bodner, and the executive director of On Demand is Sitar Nieves. We send such talented people out in the world. We incubate them like little hatchlings. And then out they go.
And then off they go. That's right.
Make other places better.
Yeah. And we love that.
And we love that. But we miss them.
Yeah. Well, there we go. 46. No, 31 minutes later, we're out of here.
Easy peasy.
Not bad. Easy peasy, lemon squeezy.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.